May it please the court. My name is Nate Kellum, and I represent the appellant, Michael Bordley. This appeal involves a facial challenge to two sections, section 2.51 and 2.52.
Do you have standing on 2.51?
Yes, Your Honor.
That deals with assemblies, meetings, gatherings, demonstrations, and parades, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Is there anything in your complaint about your client, either in the past or in planning, having a public assembly, meeting, gathering, demonstration, or parade?
Your Honor, as interpreted by the National Park Service, basically him being there trying to talk to other people would constitute a demonstration. As long as he's attracting a crowd.
Do you have anything in your complaint that supports the proposition that he has an intent to have a assembly, meeting, gathering, demonstration, or parade? Now, you've got standing for 5.2. I'm at 52. No question of the passing out of the literature. But I have a hard time finding anything in your complaint or your papers that supports the proposition that he plans to violate the face of that.
Your Honor, yes, the complaint shows that he went with other people, and so that by definition should constitute assembly. The fact that he wanted to try to talk
what
to other people.
What did he apply for in his application?
He did not apply, Your Honor.
He didn't apply.
He did not apply. And that's, of course, that's
I'm
the
really,
part of the problem.
I'm not kidding you, counsel.
I'm trying to address
in your
best I can, Chief
what it is that gives you standing on point 5.
If he's going with other people, it has to be an
assembly. Go to your complaint. Don't tell me if. Tell me what in the complaint would cause me to think that you have standing to attack point 5.1.
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint is set out in the first part of the record, Your Honor.
I realize that,
yeah.
Right in front of me, right here.
And so if you look at page 13, paragraph 17.
13, JA page or complaint page?
It's the complaint page is 3.
Okay.
The record page is
JA
13.
JA page 13, okay.
And if you look at paragraph 17, Your Honor, it says that Mr. Bordley and a few other individuals.
Traveled to Mount Rushmore to hand out free gospel tracts.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Now, that gets you .52 standing. They're there to pass out literature. I'm not sure that gets you .51 standing.
Your Honor, it does because they're necessarily a group. It's an assembly. They're going with other people.
And they're not necessarily an assembly. If they're in other parts, there's three of them. They spread out to other parts of the park. I find an inherent assembly there.
The following paragraph, they distribute tracts beside the Alley of the Flag, so they're all together. And so, Your Honor, it's an assembly.
You could have made life a lot easier for yourself and me if you had put that in the complaint that that's an assembly. I'm having a difficult time. All right, I'll let you go on that.
Thank you.
And you can go ahead and address other things.
Certainly.
But that's the best you've got on that?
Your Honor, that and also that it's certainly been a claim of the MPS that they did fall under 2.51. So it's not just our claim here, Your Honor. So when you take a look at the challenge here, 2.51, 2.52, it involves the facial validity or lack thereof of this permit scheme and its application. And I would submit to the court there's three constitutional concerns. One is its application to individuals and small groups. That's an overly broad restriction to innocuous speech. The second one is that the without unreasonable delay language, what that does is that gives an indefinite time period to the superintendent to decide whether or not to grant the permit. That's also unconstitutional. The third concern is the language about it reasonably appears to present a clear and present danger. That's unconstitutional as well because what it allows is the decision maker to consider content in a process of granting or denying the permit. In dealing with the first concern, and that is this application to individual and small group speech. Virtually every single court that has considered that issue has held that to be unconstitutional. That's what the Fourth Circuit held, that's what the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit, as well as this court in Community of Creative Nonviolence versus Turner, 1990 decision, when this court held the same thing because organization could include groups as small as two. Well, 2.5 one, 2.5 two can include groups as small as one.
And so, in your view, what's the dividing line between protected small groups and permissible permit requirements on large groups?
As large groups, I would say it's probably difficult to have a dividing line. We do know that in Thomas it involved 50 or more, and we do know that there's a concern about individual, one or two. And so it would obviously be somewhere in between, but certainly something we could say with certainty is that it can't, one is not a large group, two is not a large group. And that's what these regulations apply to. And that's the concern of Mr. Bordley.
How do we know they apply to one? 0.51, does it apply to one?
It does, because a demonstration can only involve one person, Your Honor.
Okay.
And of course, it's for good reason. And these reasons were specified in the Watchtower decision, 2002 Supreme Court decision, that talked about these types of concerns that can apply to individuals and small groups, two of which they mentioned are certainly present here. And one is spontaneity. When you have a permit process for an individual, here again, just someone who just wants to hand out a religious tract, someone who just wants to hold up a sign, that person has to go through a permit process and wait a certain period of time before they can speak, so they cannot deal with the issue of the day. President Obama makes a declaration, the Supreme Court comes down with a decision. They cannot deal with that issue on that particular day because of the permit process. And so that eliminates spontaneity. That's a real concern because citizens have a constitutional right, not only to speak, but to speak in a spontaneous manner. Another is nominimity. That as part of this permit application process, they have to give their name, they have to identify themselves. That is another concern that was pointed out in the Watchtower decision, that as citizens, we have the right to speak anonymously. There could be good reasons for wanting to speak anonymously. And so that is a concern that these two regs, Section 2.51, 2.52, directly address. And for that reason, Your Honor, along with what this court has ruled before, and certainly inconsistent with other circuits, that the application to individual and small group expression is unconstitutional. Another concern that's raised here is this without an unreasonable delay language. And what it does is it allows the superintendent to have an indefinite time period. There's no fixed time period in which to decide the matter. Now, something that has been raised by the other side is that they have a binding construction. And I would suggest to the court that the record just does not support that. They basically rely on one thing, and that is NPS Management Policy 8.6.3. And that's found on page 32 of the record. And what you'll see there is that one actually only applies to one of the provisions. Chief Judge, it only applies to 2.51. It does not apply to 2.52. So the very thing that they say is a binding construction does not even cover 2.52. And even to the extent...
I'll ask you a similar question. How quickly do you think the Constitution requires a decision on the permit?
For individual speech, it's hard to justify any
now,
fixed deadline.
Yeah, I know that's what you're asking. But I guess assuming you had a larger group, you would still
certainly
say it has to be
decided
quickly.
I think if it's a large group, certainly. I think as long as it's a fixed deadline...
How quick?
I think what they had in mind, two business days would certainly be appropriate, but I think it could be larger on that depending on the configuration of a particular park and how it was set up. And so I think the problem here is not the deadline, Judge Kavanaugh, as much as the lack of a deadline and the fact that it gives the superintendent the opportunity to create an inordinate delay and effectively deny, in some cases, the speech. And so that's the concern is present here. And so because the binding construction really is misplaced, it really doesn't apply to 2.52. It's clearly ineffective even as it would apply to 2.51, because what was shown is even with Mount Rushmore, in this very litigation, Ranger Flom submitted an affidavit and he attached a permit application. And this is found on page 40, the permit application, page 40 of the record. And in that permit application, he referenced a four-business day deadline. There was a survey taken that showed various deadlines in various parks. Some didn't have any deadlines at all. And so what's clear is that this management policy doesn't apply to 2.52 at all, and then in applying to 2.51, it's ineffective. And so it really cannot be considered a binding construction. And so with that in place, this court should rule consistently with that found in United States versus Franson, 2000 decision, 11th Circuit decision, that ruled on this very provision, 2.51, and ruled on this very phrase without unreasonable delay and held it to be unconstitutional. There's absolutely no reason for this court to be in conflict with the 11th Circuit on that point, particularly considering the constitutional freedoms at stake here and that are burdened by that vague language. The third concern here, Your Honors, is the language of reasonably appears to present a clear and present danger. This is likewise unconstitutional. And the reason is because it allows the decision maker to consider content in the decision-making process. And what's particularly troubling is the phrase that leads up to clear and present danger is called, it's reasonably appears, because that calls for a subjective judgment call. When you're allowing the decision maker to think, okay, what could create a clear and present danger?
Could clear and present danger, now that's from First Amendment cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can that not be a standard? If it's possible to permit at all, can't that be a standard?
Certainly. If it presents an actual clear and present danger, there should be no question.
How would you phrase it other than reasonably appears? How would it be constitutionally phrased?
Exactly the way it was phrased in the Thomas decision, Thomas versus City of Chicago in 2002, and that was the intended use would present a clear and present danger.
Clear and present danger.
Will present. And
now,
so
the decision maker would have to decide whether it presented a clear and present danger, right?
Yes.
And he would probably use his reasonable judgment to make that decision. He or she would use reasonable judgment to make that decision, right?
I think it would have to either present itself or not, Your Honor. And if it didn't present itself, then it'd have no basis for excluding this.
In an application, somebody would have to determine whether it presented itself or not, wouldn't they?
There's a decision maker. That's certainly
that
true.
That decision maker would have to make a decision, right?
But I think the more reasonable approach would be like the Fernandez versus Limmer decision, 1981, where the same problem was there because it said that the decision maker had a good reason to believe. And that's what the court found problematic, is because it wasn't just that you had a situation, well, okay, we've got an unreasonable danger we have to deal with.
Good reason to believe is a bit short of reasonably appears, though, isn't it?
I would think it's one of the same. I don't really see any difference in between the two, Your Honor, because in either case, what it does is it allows the decision maker to basically take.
What standard do you think the decision maker should use then in making the decision that it presents a clear and present danger?
If there is actually a clear and present danger, and this is the problem,
it's automatically predictive. We're talking about a permit situation.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So he's not seeing a clear and present danger. He has to make a decision: is this going to present a clear and present danger? And presumably that's not a standardless decision on his part. He's using
if he sees a permit application that says we want to do a treasure hunt in the national park, hey, that's going to do some damage to the property.
Yeah.
We can't allow that.
Right.
But if
I can see where he would decide that would reasonably appear to present a clear and present danger.
It would most questionably be. But if the application says that it's going to allow some anti-homosexual speech, mm-hmm. Well, that's provocative. Well, some people might not like that. Well, then that's going to be controversial. That could create a reasonably appear to present itself a clear
and present danger. Or it could present a clear and present danger.
And then just ban it.
Or it could present a clear and present danger. It might be unconstitutional for a different reason to ban the demonstration, but not because he's using judgment to determine whether it would present a clear and present danger, because he has to use judgment.
I think when he has that vague language, that's what it allows, Your Honor. That's certainly what it appears. That's what Fernandez held, and I think that certainly ought to be a decision this court ought to consider as well. And that is a clear distinction with Thomas, because Thomas did not have that qualifier that's present here and that was present in Fernandez. And so those were the three constitutional concerns that we see that we believe would make these two provisions facially invalid. If there are any questions of the court, I would just sit down and reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court? Robin Merriweather, representing the Department of the Interior. The permit requirements that are at issue in this case are content neutral. They're narrowly tailored to further several government interests.
Do they have standing as to 0.51? I know you didn't address that in your brief, but it jumped out at me as a question. Do they have standing to a challenge 0.51?
I believe you're right, Your Honor. I don't. I've reviewed the complaint during counsel's presentation, and their reference to Boardley's future activities, which actually occurred during the course of litigation, was leafleting and not an assembly.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
And we would note that the regulations further several government interests, which are set forth in detail in our brief, as well as the Wink Declaration.
Such as tranquility? Tranquility usually is not an interest that justifies restricting speech.
Well, Your Honor, actually, we're not.
We'd all like tranquility on the sidewalk, but usually that's not sufficient to tell people that they have to get a permit before they hand you something.
That is actually only one of the interests. The interest that's discussed at great length is our need to accommodate speech, and that includes a law enforcement component, a public safety and preservation.
I don't understand the public safety component. Why do you need a permit for two people to go hand out leaflets in a national park when large groups might come in? They're not going to be handing out permits. They're just there to see things. They don't have to get a permit. I don't understand, and they're going to pose much more of a public safety risk.
We need to be able to accommodate the event that's taking place. And what plaintiffs, Mr. Boardley's counsel...
You call it an event, but these regulations apply to individuals in small groups, which is the problem. Basically, every court has held that a permitting requirement has to have an exception for individuals in small groups, and there is none here.
Actually, I would disagree with you on a couple of points. First of all, we cannot ignore the audience, and that's what Mr. Boardley is focusing entirely on, whether there's one or two people speaking. But the permit application asks, for one thing, whether the speaker or the assembler anticipates a crowd, whether there's been advertisement. So one person could lead to a group of 1,000 people.
Well, sure. Well, I don't understand that. What do you mean one person could lead to 1,000?
If Sarah Palin decides to give a speech in front of Mount Rushmore, she may be a single speaker.
Okay,
but that
so
is a
individual
large assembly.
Speakers, based on the popularity or unpopularity or their message, have to get permits?
No, actually, we need every speaker. There is not a content-based determination of who needs to apply for a permit. Everyone needs to apply for a permit. There are factors and circumstances that speech can generate.
I don't understand that last factor either. You're making small groups or single speakers apply for permits because they might draw a crowd?
That's only one issue.
Tranquility is one, and that's one that we don't normally think is good enough to defeat free speech. The fact that you might draw a crowd is not one I've seen a lot of adjudication of in the past, but it's not one that sounds very compelling.
Well, one thing that's different between this case and some of the other cases which plaintiff cites, and that gets to me to the second point that I disagreed with your statement, Judge mm-hmm. Kavanaugh, which is that many of the cases that Boardley cites do not set a general rule that there must be a small group exception for speech to be constitutional. In many of the cases, there were involved absolute bans on speech as opposed to a permit requirement like ours, which simply requires that we have advance notice so that we can prepare for the speech. And they also involved very different areas. What's different about this case?
Maybe, but I looked at the cases, and the leading law review article, I think, summarizes them. Courts routinely hold that a permit requirement imposed on individual or small group speech to be unduly burdensome. And I looked at all the cases cited, and that's true.
And yet the Eighth Circuit upheld the very regulations.
The Eighth Circuit didn't consider this issue.
But the regulations were...
I know, but this argument was not raised in the Eighth Circuit case, so the Eighth Circuit actually didn't consider this issue.
And I would also note that in our case, we have a record which establishes, particularly in the Wink Declaration, the situations that can arise, the fact that small groups simply are not benign. I don't know if in the other cases the record...
Let's take that to its logical conclusion. This is a national park. There's a lot of space for people to avoid the speaker. Can you do this on sidewalks?
That's the difference that I was trying to allude to, Your Honor. We're dealing with the entire park system, which consists of 391 parks. They are not all very large spaces. There are some spaces that are the size not much bigger than this courtroom. In those environments, you don't have a lot of wide open space for people to go around.
Well, all sidewalks are that way. Can you do it on all sidewalks and say you need a permit to hand out a leaflet on a sidewalk because, gee, it's crowded and you might draw, you know, a group around you, and that might somehow upset the tranquility or cause a public safety issue? I just don't get it.
Well, sidewalks are highly trafficked areas, and the sidewalks that have been at issue in First Amendment cases.
Some are, and some aren't.
The sidewalks that have been at issue in the cases that are discussed in this arena are in more urban areas, and again, we're dealing with some.
But do we really have that problem here? Because I thought that these were designated free speech areas that we're talking about. So hasn't the Park Service already made a decision about the venue here? We're not talking about every place in every national park, correct?
Well, the permit, one thing that the permit is designed to ensure is that the demonstration or leafleting is occurring in a designated free speech area. One of the criteria for denying a permit is if the person who seeks the permit has chosen to engage in their activity in an area that is not open for speech. Again, it's not about preventing people from
engaging
in
speech. But you require everyone who wants to speak anywhere in any national park to get a permit. A more narrowly tailored regulation would carve out certain areas as protected. But this is, you set foot in any national park in the United States and you want to hand out a leaflet, you have to get a permit, right?
Yes, you apply
and
for
that,
a permit.
That doesn't help your argument to say some parks are small. You're the ones that made the regulation apply to all of the parks.
That's
right. If you had a regulation here that says in parks that are less than 0.9 acres, you have to get permits, you might have a very different argument. But that's part of the plaintiff's argument, is this is overbroad. And you can't help yourself on the overbreadth by saying, well, we have some parks where it would be valid.
That's one of the arguments, Your Honor, but there's no requirement in the Constitution that we issue separate regulations for each of the 391.
There's no requirement in the Constitution you issue regulations. The Constitution protects their speech. That's where your problem comes in. It protects their speech. It doesn't empower, it doesn't require your regulations at all.
And we are allowing speech, and again, I just would like to...
You're regulating speech.
We are regulating speech.
The Constitution allows it.
We're
regulating.
Yes, we're imposing time, place, and manner restrictions so that we have the advance notice that we need to prepare for and accommodate the First Amendment activity that people are engaging in. Again, we are not, the suggestion that we are making a content-based decision that we don't want speech to occur is simply not true and is refuted by the record. We have routinely grant permits. This is not a bar that precludes individuals from leafleting or engaging in any
sure,
other activity.
Sure, but people are chilled because it's a pain to apply for a permit, which is something the Supreme Court has repeatedly stated.
But the interest that we have that requires it is that we need to, for example, parks are not, unlike the D.C. area, many parks are not staffed at a high enough level to be able to respond to any situations that arise when speech is going on. And we need the notice to prepare, to create a plan, to have the staff and the facilities available to accommodate the speech. Now, Mr. Bordley may say that there are some speakers who will not have a need for any extra facilities, but the First Amendment does not require us to adopt the least restrictive alternative.
But it does require narrow tailoring, doesn't it?
It does, and we have explained why this is narrowly tailored, because we have a need to staff and prepare for and have the facilities available for the speech activity.
Well, you have a need to do that, clearly, when it's a large group. But if you're talking about an individual or a very small group, and you don't have any exception for that, the question is whether that's narrowly tailored. Now, you've responded by saying, well, maybe, you know, there's a potential that if it's a speaker who would be very popular, then, you know, you might need to respond as if it were a large group. But that, you know, is purely speculative. I mean, it depends on all kinds of different things.
But it's not speculative. And one of the things that the permit application asks is it asks for the type of information that allows us to make that judgment as to whether or not the activity will require additional facilities, require additional staffing, require additional law enforcement.
Suppose a large city has a budget crisis and has to cut its police force and therefore can't respond quickly to any crowd and therefore says, you know what, as part of this, we're going to require a permit for anyone to hand out leaflets on any sidewalk in the city because we can't have police quickly respond. Would that be constitutional?
It would depend on whether they were in a circuit where those sidewalks had already been deemed to be inherently public forums in which...
Well, I'm assuming everything here is a public forum, yeah.
Well,
I just don't think that justification that we can't quickly enough get staff on the scene is going to be enough to suppress speech.
Again, we're not suppressing speech in this situation, and we are trying to accommodate speech and accommodate the speakers. There are many speakers for whom we have the fact that
you
we
seem
have,
to think that the baseline is the government's able to restrict all speech and you're being benevolent by accommodating speech, but the Constitution starts from a different baseline.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that we
well, you are say. Suppressing speech. You can't keep a straight face and say you're not suppressing speech. By requiring permits, speech is more suppressed than it is if it's not requiring permits. You have to win on justification for suppressing speech. It doesn't make sense for you to say we're not suppressing speech, we're allowing speech. You don't get to allow speech. Question is whether you can suppress it. It's allowed without you.
I guess what I was
if
trying
to... If you've done nothing, it's allowed.
What I was trying to differentiate between, Your Honor, is that we're attempting to accommodate speech. There certainly is a First Amendment right. We in no way attempt to deny people that right, and there's evidence in the record that we routinely grant permits. There is no evidence of any permit being denied based on at Mount Rushmore, which there's evidence in the record about, and it is not a content-based restriction. Instead, the Park Service has determined that throughout the park system, given our administrative issues, the need for conservation, and the law enforcement and public safety concerns that we have, that we need to know what will be occurring in the parks so that we can...
Any alternative avenue for communication available for somebody who doesn't want to apply for a permit?
Within the park? Well, they could... If they don't want a permit... It depends on what they're trying to do. If they want to leaflet, then no, they need to get a permit, and then they can leaflet within park grounds. Well, I should take that back. Unless they're in the DC National Capital Region, which is governed by separate regulations. But in the rest of the park system, they need a permit.
Go ahead. I was just gonna say, someone like Mr. Bordley handing out gospel tracts or whatever, there is no alternative. He must get a permit.
Well, he actually, in fact, on this record, he did hand out leaflets without a permit, and that's set forth in the complaint. It was only after he was handing out the leaflets that the park police informed him, park staff informed him that he needed to apply for a permit and that he had been violating the law. He was not prosecuted for that.
There's not a lawful alternative to getting a permit, right?
Not with
you have not provided.
Grounds.
There is not provided an alternative thing to do other than get the permit, right?
Not in park grounds outside of the National Capital Region.
If I want to get a group of 500 people to go sightsee, not to hand out leaflets, do I have to get a permit?
There are permits for non-First Amendment activities. In fact, the permit for Mount Rushmore references that there are permits for non-First Amendment activities as well. I don't know that just
in other words,
sightseeing would
let me phrase the question differently. Does every large group have to get a permit just to visit?
I don't believe so, just to walk through the park.
Right, so the interest in conservation, public safety seems a mismatch because if it was just an interest in having staff being able to respond to large groups or an interest in conservation, it would seem that you would need a permit regardless of whether you're going to speak, this permit requirement only applies if you're going to speak.
But you could say that, Your Honor. I see my time is up, but if I can answer your question.
You can always answer the question.
Okay, thank you. You could say that regarding any permit requirement. For example, if you're a group of 50 people and you want to assemble outside of this courthouse, you would need to have a permit. But if 50 people or 100 people wanted to come to hear argument today, they wouldn't have to have a permit. So I would just say I don't think that point renders our situation.
If we were required for the assembly outside the courthouse, then we would have a possibly litigable question as to whether the terms of that particular scheme were constitutional or not. We actually have had some on D.C. regulations. I don't remember a facial one, but as applied. I don't see where you get anywhere by that distinction. The distinction is in the park, how are you serving? How is this a narrowly tailored regulation to serve an interest of the government that is sufficient to outweigh the First Amendment rights of the petitioners?
Yes. And
each of the things you've offered when we ask you further questions about, you say, well, that's just one. But I'm not sure that any of them have gained a lot of weight, and more particularly this one about the safety and conservation. How is a group that is speaking a greater danger to the environment, conservation, to law enforcement, than is a group that's out there showing the Boy Scouts out of the woods look?
Well, if a group, the parks are aware of the visitors that pass through the parks in each site on a routine basis. We are prepared to respond to the routine traffic at the parks, but an assembly is something different, and what these regulations are designed for is to give us the notice so that we can prepare a plan.
But the assembly being different is not, the rules don't tell us an assembly of more than 5,000 persons. It just says an assembly, which would seem to include two persons.
Yes, and though I acknowledge that Your Honors have not agreed with me, we've articulated the reasons that a small group is not benign, and we have detailed the concerns that we have. And
you don't have to be benign to have free speech. They get this under the Constitution. I'm not sure what you mean that they're not benign. They may be very benign, or they may not, but that doesn't tell me why they have to get a permit to speak.
Because the Constitution allows us to impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Permits are a quintessential example of those types of restrictions. And our point is that small groups cannot be presumed to have absolutely no impact on the safety, preservation, and public health concerns that we
permit requirements are also the quintessential reason, or licensing requirements, why we have a First Amendment. Now, with the history of this in England, is why the founders were so concerned about making sure free speech was enshrined in the Constitution. So that's why the Supreme Court since then has been so concerned about permitting requirements, and it's never, best I can tell, allowed a permitting requirement for such a small group or for individuals.
Right, and I would just note that the issue is not directly raised in the other cases, and that many of the interests that we have articulated mirror the interests that the Supreme Court and this Court have recognized in other cases. It just so happens that the small group question was not presented in those cases and is presented in ours, and we would urge you to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. How much time do you have left? Pardon? We'll round that up to 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
As set out in Ward, the standard is whether these regulations affect substantially more speech than necessary to further the government interest. And we would submit that it does so in three respects. One that we've harped on a good bit in the briefing and an argument, and that is the application to individual and small groups. That is an overly broad restriction and is facially invalid on that point alone. The other two arguments that we've brought to this court's attention that we think merit attention as well is the without unreasonable delay. That is troubling language, and without a sufficient binding construction, it allows the decision maker to indefinitely delay the decision, which is problematic from a constitutional standpoint. And then the third is the the coupling of the reasonably appears in a clear and present danger. And so those are our concerns, Your Honor, and we bring before the court and we ask that this court reverse the decision of the court below and find sections 2.51 and 2.52 facially unconstitutional. Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is submitted. Give us a recess.